ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Will Davies, who is the author of a new book called The Last 100 Days. Will Davies would describe himself as a historian, a writer, and a filmmaker. Others, such as Major General Gordon Maitland, say that Will is more than an historian. He has that rare gift of being a story weaver. His bestseller, Somme Mud, remains etched on my memory, and I can assure you his new work, The Last 100 Days, is no less moving. Will, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill, very much.
So, Will, the title of your new book about World War One is The Last 100 Days. It's a somewhat biblical description, I suppose, but it takes us back from Armistice Day to about August. Why did you particularly want to focus on that period?
Well, the period has become known as the last 100 days. It's commonly called the last 100 days. It's not exactly 100 days. It's sort of 95 or something. But the last 100 days of the war was hugely significant for the Allies and certainly for the Australians. There's been this interesting lag. It took a while for people to understand that the war moved, our war, Australians' war, moved on from Gallipoli to the Western Front. People knew about Gallipoli and they were sort of stuck there. I mean, we had far massive casualties on the Western Front, far, far more than the 7,000 killed at Gallipoli. And it's a bit like that with the last 100 days. The history is sort of lagging back in Passchendaele, October, late 17. Now we're into late 18 and no one really knows about the period from the Battle of Hamel in July 18 through to the end of the war. And this was a bit of history I thought needed to be covered and told.
It's well deserving of a new look at it. But I wonder if I could take you back a bit further, back to, say, the 1st of November 1917, when a new Australian Corps was formed. What difference do you think it made to have an Australian Corps?
The Australians, as we would know, always operated under the British Army, under British command, under British generalship, and that really didn't change. I mean, what did change is that the five Australian divisions came from different parts of the British Army and were now combined into the biggest corps, actually, I think of all, there were five Australian divisions, and that remained under the command of Birdwood, and then in May 18, the Australian Corps were given, General John Monash was given command of the Australian Corps at that point. But it was an important thing for the Australians. The Australians had argued for their own control, their own command, their own sense of identity, separate as much as possible to the rest of the British Army. And it was very, very important. I mean, Billy Hughes had argued for this. The Australian senior command had looked towards this. And the men, of course, they felt naturally Australian and separate and very different from British, Canadian, you know, New Zealanders even, as their own force and their own, they had their own way of working and their own way of fighting and training. And this allowed them to feel an Australian entity rather than a British entity.
And that was reflected in one thing that is often noticed among Australians, is that they started putting the brim of their, the side brim of the hat up, didn't they?
They did. When they wanted to throw a little tanty, they'd put their brim up. And it was like a lovely sign of, you know, who we are. And the Australians right through the war were very confident, very self-confident. They knew their own fighting capabilities. They were often contemptuous of other armies. But there was a cheekiness, a rudeness, an arrogance, and things like putting their brim up was a statement that was important to them.
And the Australian Diggers had a great reputation even among the Germans, and there were several peaks, I think, in battles that we remember, the Second Battle of Villers-Bretonneux, but Le Mel on 4 July 1918 the big difference then, there was the new Australian commander you've mentioned, John Monash. His great claim, I suppose, was that he made full use of his resources, including some American troops. But do you see that as a turning point?
Well, certainly a turning point in the evolution of new tactics. And those tactics then were adopted and used very successfully on the 8th of August. Monash really just rethought what was going on. He codified it in a way. He put it together very, very cleverly. I mean, he had an engineering mind, a logical, clear, perceptive mind, and he did things, you know, in a very mechanical and well-thought-out way. I mean, odd things like, you know, the fighting at Le Hamel was in wheat fields. I mean, there was no, wasn't churned up mud like Passchendaele or the Somme. So he would randomly land a shell where he wanted, just to blow a hole in the field. And these looked to the Germans like just a random shell fell and blew a hole. But these were very carefully mapped, so he gave the men cover. And these are little things. He, again, with the aid of an Australian flying officer, Wackett, he was able to deliver ammunition out of aircraft, do an airdrop of ammunition for the first time ever in a war. You would think it would have happened before, but the men had laid out a big V-coloured panel with a V on it, V for Vickers, and that meant we need ammunition, small arms ammunition, and a plane had drop a couple of boxes to them. Very handy.
Yes, there was an enormous amount of planning that perhaps distinguished him from the other generals.
And he was naturally concerned about casualties. How do I apply them? A most amount of firepower, concentrated firepower, training. How can I reduce casualties? I mean, in the case of Hamel, for the 3 weeks before the battle, he just shelled the German lines at 3 a.m. every morning with gas and high explosive. The Germans would go, here we are, 3 o'clock, you know, wake up, pull their gas masks on, go back to bed and good night, nurse. I mean, it was just how they saw it. Well, of course, the morning of the battle, the aerial bombardment came again at 3 a.m., but this time there was no gas, you know, but the Germans still pulled their gas masks on. There was smoke and high explosive. And of course, when the Australians found them, they were still huddled up in bed and covers on their guns. And these are the sort of tricky things that Monash carefully thought through.
And the result is there. I think it was planned to last for 90 minutes. It didn't last much longer, did it?
History tells us it lasted 93. I think there's some others recently have decided that they were there before 90 minutes. And if you know the Wolfsburg above Le Hamel, the place they took where the Australian Corps Park Memorial is today, you stand there and you look back, and I take my tours there regularly, and I look back and think, I couldn't even walk that far in 90 minutes. You know, these guys were running and fighting you know, they had to get up there in 90 minutes. It was a long way.
Yes, another point in the book, you talk about what the diggers had to carry on them, which is just the feat of lifting it all.
I know. You know, 200 rounds of ammunition is not light. You know, they had a shovel or a pick, they had sandbags, had their basic webbing, they had their gas mask on their chest, they would have had, you know, a little bit of emergency rations, a couple of tins of bully beef and biscuits, they would have, I mean, it all added up, water, bayonets, you know, a collapsible pick, and was all weight, and they were very fit. I mean, they do regular route marches of long distances. These guys were seriously fit, so probably for most of them, the carrying of what they had to carry was not that much of a problem. But the other thing that Monash did, he brought into this battle carrier tanks. And carrier tanks were just able to support a huge amount of material. There's a great line of commanding officer of the 13th Battalion arriving in during the Battle of Hamel to see this massive pile of stuff on the hillside. And it was what 1,200 men would take to carry, and a couple of carrier tanks had dropped water and star pickets and wire and ammunition just came out of the back of this tank, you know, and saved the labour of 1,200 men. So those sort of things really, really contributed to a different sort of battle.
And we're speaking today with Will Davies, who is the author of The Last 100 Days, The Australian Road to Victory in the First World War, talking about the Battle of Le Hamel, and there were some inspiring words spoken at the time by the French Prime Minister, Clemenceau. It was extraordinary the lengths he went to talk about the Australian troops, wasn't it?
He did. He gave this very passionate speech of, you know, I've looked into their eyes and I know that they'll fight with us to the end sort of thing. But Clemenceau used to every Sunday he'd go and visit a French unit somewhere along the line. This time he took the Sunday to go to the Australians after the success at Hamel, and that was quite unique, quite rare. Well, I don't know that he probably ever did it to any other non-French unit. So him coming to the Australians, delivering the speech in English, not in French, was something very special. He must have realised the value of that small, very small victory, certainly in terms of morale and in pushing the Germans back from Villebretonneux and away from Amiens. If the Germans could get to Amiens, 19 kilometres away, they could virtually take the train to Paris. The war was over.
Major importance. And meanwhile, the Aussies, the diggers, were just getting about their business, and they had a couple of unique expressions, I think. The Germans were either individually or altogether called Fritz.
Fritz, they were. They weren't called Krauts. They were called Fritz, yeah, generally. The Hun, they're called the Hun.
Oh, yes.
Too. Yep.
Then the major actions had a name as well, didn't they? Which we can sort of understand, but it's a little bit flippant, I suppose, when you think about what was happening. Stunts.
Yes, stunts. They were known as stunts, jumping the bags, a few things, but stunts was a common thing. They also at this time developed into 1918, and they perfected this thing called peaceful penetration, which was really just trench raiding. And they got very good at it, and the Germans were seriously fearful of the coming at night, particularly, of unexpected trench attacks. The Australians dominated that they owned no man's land in the night. They'd not only trench raid, but they did this thing called nibbling, which was they'd push out a few posts and just dig very shallow gun emplacements, put a couple of men there, and so they just push this, keep pressure on the Germans. The next night they'd put a couple more posts out and they'd between them, and say the third night they'd link them up into a trench. So they were just forcing the pace, forcing the approach on the Germans all the time. And they didn't react perhaps as they might have earlier in the war, where they would have either heavily shelled it or they would have counterattacked it. But by this time, the Germans were on their knees. They were down to, you know, boys of 16, as were the British. But they weren't in an offensive state of mind. They were seriously defensive, even though they weren't preparing their trench lines very well at all. And this came out soon after in the attack, where masses of Germans were captured, quite happily throwing up their hands. The war for them was over. They knew the pain at home. The submarine blockade was starving the nation. The letters from Germany, their wives talked of so much social dislocation and starvation. They were eating turnips and cattle feed and stuff, grass. All they wanted to do was get the war over, and the best way they could do it is surrender and happily get out of it alive.
And the soldiers on the German soldiers on the battlefield had another thing to contend with. There was a practice among the Australians of what they called ratting. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Ratting. Ratting's a common term, and I don't know why the Australians were so good at it or so. But it's basically just theft and stripping prisoners of anything. I mean, their medals, their watch, their wedding ring, their photos, anything they can take, they would take. And there's a lovely, in the book, there's a great quote I found of a group of British soldiers marching some German prisoners back behind the line, and the Australians realised that these were soldiers from Salonika. They were British soldiers recently on the Western Front. They didn't know about stripping prisoners. So they just basically formed a line across the road, and as the prisoners came through, they just methodically stripped the whole line of prisoners. And I don't know how many watches and all sorts of stuff they got, but they were right into it. I mean, whether they were pistols or helmets or binoculars. So really, I mean, there's a great story of one famous ratter, probably the most famous one of all, Barney Hines, who stole a grand piano. And he was seen pushing, looking for mates to help him with a grand piano.
Well, there were a few funny events amid all the carnage, and one you describe is where one of our famous and very revered leaders, Pompey Elliott, I think it was after they'd taken Peron, and he was going to cross the Seine and actually fell in and had to continue without his pants.
He did. Pompey was you know, wanted to be out there leading. And, of course, the New South Wales battalions had taken Mont St. Quentin just to the north, and Pompey wanted to show his fighting abilities, so he strode out on this fallen bridge across the Somme and toppled into the river, got soaking wet and was dragged out, and you know, this was a great joke to them. You know, the wireless, the telegraphic men went wild. I mean, messages went up and down the line, you know, ha-ha, Pompey's in the river. But he did. He was seen in his nightshirt, various descriptions of him running around without his pants and with just his shirt and for the rest of the day, but he was determined to get on with the war.
And we're speaking today with Will Davies, who is the author of The Last 100 Days. Will, there's a lot of talk about the enormous number of prisoners that were taken, number of German prisoners that were taken. What would happen to those men?
Well, for example, on the first day of on the 8th of August, we captured around 7,000 Germans. Canadians captured over 6,000. What would happen was that they were generally escorted back, but times when you're advancing and fighting, you don't have men to spare to actually escort prisoners back. Sometimes they were taken back under the watchful eye of the walking wounded. Sometimes the light horse might escort them back. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that wonderful painting in the War Memorial of a light horseman with his rifle over his shoulder walking behind a group of German prisoners, and it's just called the Drover. These Germans, when they're captured, they were only too happy to hold their hands high and just run back and take themselves back. So they'd go back to the big prisoner compound in the sort of cage in at Villebretonneux, and they would be separated. Officers and other ranks would be separated, and then they would be fairly methodically questioned, although, you know, dealing with 7,000 in a day is a bit of a hard task. But intelligence was crucial, and intelligence only lasts a very, very short time. So when you capture someone, you must interrogate them within an hour or two, or what they know is now irrelevant. So I don't quite know the process, but they did have German-speaking officers, intelligence, people that spoke German that could quickly do this. They were very organized, again, in how they dealt with prisoners. And when you read the sort of standing orders for the day, there's paragraphs of how you deal with prisoners, where they go. That was all carefully planned too.
Now, we're coming up to the end of the war, and of course our infantry didn't know this for sure. There were rumours, no doubt. But when the armistice was announced on the 11th of November, what was the reaction of the Australian troops?
The Australians, two things come out of the research. The first is they had no real inkling of this, and even the officers didn't. So they weren't standing by ready for this sort of armistice to happen. And remember, they were out of the line. Their last infantry action was the 5th of October. So they're well and truly behind the lines, back in camps, even way out of shelling range. They're relaxing. They're still training. The war's still going on. They're getting ready to go forward. In the case of Edward Lynch in Somme Mud, he's on a train to go back into the fighting, and they don't believe, when they hear the news, they don't believe that the war's over. Edward Lynch talks about, we didn't believe it until we saw an English newspaper with the war's over on the newspaper. They just, even official communiques, the men were sort of half-hearted and pretty sceptical. And then when it did come, and they did realise the war was actually over, there was not wild rejoicing. Unlike the French civilian population, everyone went crazy. They were quite subdued. You know, there are cases where they joined the French and danced in the street and all of that. But their mind quickly turned to their mates who were not there to join them in this momentous day. And secondly, once that was out of their mind, when am I going home?
And I suppose what would make it difficult also is the enormous waste on that very last day.
There is a note in the book that some 10,000 men were wounded on the last day. The British and the Americans just kept fighting. The Americans in particular were just absolutely stupid and nasty. They believed that they really wanted to get back at the Germans. They only had a few hours, in fact, to do it. They had a lot of shells piled up in their guns, and they wanted to fire off everything they could. By the end of that day, and we're talking about the ceasefire happening at 11 a.m., there were 10,000 casualties, of which it's estimated 2,700 died on the last day of the war.
Mm. Look, this is an incredible story. We're speaking today with Will Davies, who is the author of The Last 100 Days. Will, there's so many more avenues we could explore, and there's so much more in your book. We've reached a stage of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which song you've picked?
Look, I'd like the band played Waltzing Matilda. It's a song that brings a tear still to my eyes when I hear it. In 2015, I was able to take Eric Bogle to Gallipoli. He'd never been before. And we had an alternate, very large alternate dawn service because I was a guide on that day and we had a very large alternate service. And Eric sang The Band Plays Waltzing Matilda. Really, really was an emotional moment as the sort of sun came up over the Dardanelles. And I think that might be my pick.
Now when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, well, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time you stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun. And they marched me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off for Gallipoli. And how well I remember that terrible day, how our blood stained the sand and the water, and of how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was waiting, he'd primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shell. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia. But the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. We buried ours and the Turks buried theirs. Then we started all over. And those that were left, well, we tried to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I woke up in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, well, I wished I was dead. Never knew there was worse things than dying, for I'll go no more waltzing Matilda. All around the green bush far and free, to hum tents and pegs, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. So they gathered the crippled, the wounded, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. the legless, the armless, the blind, the insane, those proud wounded heroes of Suvla. And as our ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me. To grieve, to mourn, and to pity. But the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. But nobody cheered, they just stood and stared. Then they turned all their faces away. And so now, every April, I sit on me porch and I watch the parade pass before me. And I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reviving old dreams of past glories. And the old men march slowly, all bones stiff and sore. They're tired old heroes from a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question.
And that was Eric Bogle singing, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you to our guest, Will Davies. Thank you very much for being in on Dad's on the Air.
Thanks, mate, very much. And can I just do one other little quick thing? If people are now discovering their heritage, they're looking at that photo on the wall of that man with the slouch hat and saying, who's that old fella, or that young fella? And they're beginning their family research in a far deeper way, and this history is a important part of that. And I'm regularly taking ancestors back. We visit graves. I can often point out where a man's body might lie. I know where the attack went in. I know he was killed on that day, and I can say, well, he's in an area the size of a football field or tennis court even. So if anyone's interested, I can give you my email. It's just info@willdavies.net.au. info@willdavies.net.au.
And that will also be on our website for people that are interested in perhaps going on a tour with Will. That's it for this week. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.